All right, welcome to episode 3 of the Foundation section in Christian Ambassador Training. My name is David W. Gilmore. I'm a writer and speaker with Legati Christi. And this entire class is based on making truth claims about the world and things that have been revealed to us. And in fact, any class that you take or article that you read or video that you watch, it's making some sort of truth claim. So I thought it's important for us to talk briefly about what truth is and how we can determine what is true and what is false. When we start talking about truth, the first thing we should ask is, what is truth? Pilate famously asked Jesus this question during his execution in John 18, verse 38. And Pilate was trying to be profound here, but it really isn't all that difficult of an answer when you think about it a little bit. And because philosophers like to overly complicate things so they can have something to debate, myself included, there's multiple definitions of truth. And I'm not going to bore you with the debate on how we define truth. So we're just going to go with what is known as the correspondence theory of truth. This definition says that truth is when an idea, belief, or statement matches or corresponds with the way the world actually is, or reality. This theory is often referred to as the common sense theory of truth. In this view, reality determines what's true or false. So a fact is true only if it matches reality. Here are some examples of true statements. Los Angeles is a city in the state of California. Dave has a cat named Zuko. Or a square is a two-dimensional object with four equal sides whose interior angles are 90 degrees. Right now, if you're saying to yourself, duh, Captain Obvious, then you understand why this is called the common sense view of truth. An important idea to keep in mind is that truth is discovered, not invented. For example, the Earth didn't transform from flat to round when we discovered it was round. It had always been round. It just took a while to figure it out. Despite what some internet chat rooms say, right? Also, gravity has always been there, holding us onto the planet. Gravity wasn't invented with Newton. He just did experiments in order to determine that there was an invisible natural force at play, making apples fall off of on people's heads as they sat under trees. So there's two types of truth. First is objective truth. An objective truth is something that's true for everyone, whether they agree with it or not. It's true for me and for you, and for everyone else. These truths are subject independent. They don't rely on people thinking them to be true in order to be true. Objective truth exists independently of anyone's knowledge of it. Back to our example of Newton and gravity. Gravity existed before Newton. It didn't just come into existence once Newton proposed his theory. And despite people thinking he was a weirdo or not understanding his theory back then, they still benefited from gravity even though they didn't believe in it or understand it. Objective truth is transcultural. If something is true, it's true for all people in all places at all times. 2 + 2 = 4 for everyone, everywhere, at every time. Doesn't matter where you were born or when, 2 + 2 has always been 4. Something that's objectively true is unchanging even though our beliefs about the truth change. When we began to believe that the Earth was round instead of flat, the truth about the Earth didn't change, only our belief about the Earth changed. If everyone suddenly believed that the Earth was flat, the Earth wouldn't become flat, it would still be round, and we would have wrong belief. Beliefs cannot change a fact, no matter how sincerely the belief is held. Truth doesn't care about sincerity. Someone can sincerely believe that the world is flat, but that only makes that person sincerely mistaken. Objective truth is not affected by the attitude or the personality of the person professing it. An arrogant person doesn't make the truth that he professes false. If someone who is a real jerk and a generally nasty, despicable person says, "Oh yeah, well Los Angeles is a city in California, you greasy monkey-faced pus bubble," he said a true thing. On the flip side, a humble, kind, and gentle person does not make the error he professes true. It doesn't matter how kind and loving and caring you are or how sincerely you believe it. Dave is not 6 foot tall unless he's standing on a stepladder. The second type of truth is subjective truth. This is something true based on the subject. If I say cookies and cream is the best ice cream, that's something that's true for me, the subject. If I didn't hold the view that cookies and cream is the best ice cream, then it would not be true. Or, Dave is short. Short compared to what? To the average person, yeah, I'm short. But in that ball pit at the toddler birthday party, however, I'm like King Kong, baby. Also, if I didn't exist, then it would not be true that Dave is short, because I, the subject, don't exist. If the subject doesn't exist, then a subjective true statement is false. Make sense? The process of discovering truth begins with a few laws of logic that are called the first principles. We call these first principles because they are the foundation that everything else is built on. We call these laws self-evident. Because when you hear them, you'll think to yourself, duh, that's obvious. Now, don't worry if the description sounded a little wordy or abstract or technical. I promise. In the end, duh. There are about 7 of these laws, but I'm only going to go over 2 of the main ones. The first is known as the law of non-contradiction. Simply put, something can't be A and not A at the same time in the same sense. In other words, the opposite of true is false. And we use this law every day when we make decisions, even though we don't know its fancy name. For example, we know you can't be married and not married at the same time. You can't be pregnant and not pregnant at the same time. I can't be Dave and not Dave at the same time. Like I said, duh, right? The second law I want to talk about is called the law of excluded middle. Now, this law says that either something is or it isn't. For example, either God exists or he doesn't. Either Jesus rose from the dead or he didn't. There's no kind of rose from the dead. There's no God kind of exists. It may seem hard to spot the difference in these 2 laws because it's very subtle. The law of non-contradiction tells us that no statement can be both true and false. And the law of excluded middle tells us that true things must be one or the other. Without these first principles, we couldn't learn anything and discover what is true and what is not. Do these things seem like common sense? That's why they're called self-evident. Even if we weren't able to give a precise definition of these principles, we use them intuitively every single day. That's why they're self-evident. First principles can tell us how to discover truth, but they can't tell us what is true. For that, we need to start using our faculties of reason. This leads us to another question. How do we know things? How do we know the attributes of humans? How do I know that Steve and Susanna are humans? The simple answer is that we determine what's true and what's false by observing the world around us and then drawing general conclusions. This is called reasoning. There are different types of reasoning. The first that we're going to look at is called inductive reasoning. And we use inductive reasoning all the time and probably don't realize it. Inductive reasoning involves drawing conclusions based on our experiences of the world. For example, if someone said, my cat hatched from an egg. I've observed enough of the world and enough cats to know that cats are not born by hatching from eggs. They're born through the birthing process, and I can know this despite not seeing this particular cat being born. Inductive reasoning doesn't give us absolute certainty. Inductive reasoning gives us reasonable conclusions. For example, if I say, the sun will come up tomorrow, I'm making this statement based on the fact that the sun has appeared in the sky every day since the earth was formed. And until something happens to persuade me otherwise, like say I see some kind of a report that says a meteor is going to hit the planet and knock it off its axis, the most reasonable conclusion is that the sun will come up tomorrow. Now, a second type of reasoning is called deductive reasoning. In deductive reasoning, you take observations and come to a conclusion. And that starts with forming arguments. Now, arguments have a number of premises that lead to a conclusion. The argument is considered a valid one if the conclusion logically follows from the premises. For example, Steve is a human. All humans are mortal. Therefore, Steve is mortal. The conclusion logically follows the premises. The first premise states that Steve is human. The second claims that all humans are mortal. So, if Steve is human, and if humans are mortal, then Steve must be mortal. Now, the bigger question here is, how do we know that Steve is a human? Maybe Steve is a rock. And how do we know that all humans are mortal? This argument just asserts it and doesn't tell us how we know this. Here's another example of an argument that makes this problem even more apparent. Susanna is a human. All humans have wings. Therefore, Susanna has wings. This argument is also logically valid. The conclusion logically follows the premises. If all humans have wings, and if Susanna is a human, then it logically follows that Susanna has wings. But we know this argument is false because we know that the second premise is false. Without having to do any Googling, we know that humans don't have wings. So, for an argument to be considered a good argument, we have to have some sort of evidence or warrant to believe that they're true rather than false. And we can rely on observational evidence in the case of the second premise, or the first, to know that it's false. We have certainly observed a lot of humans in our lifetime. Even if you've seen one human with wings, you've likely seen some without them, which would mean that not all humans have wings. And therefore, we can't conclude that Susanna has wings based solely on this argument. The final type of reasoning we'll discuss is abductive reasoning. And this type of reasoning is based on probability. We have a series of facts, and we're looking for the best explanation of the facts. We come up with all possible explanations and start eliminating them until we reach a conclusion. For example, if I come downstairs in the morning and I discover that someone ate my cookies and cream ice cream, I can go through a process of elimination to deduce who it was. The possible suspects in this case would include my wife, or my daughter, or my son, or the cat. Or maybe some monster broke into my house, left everything else untouched, and ate my ice cream. First, I check the outside camera. Nobody came into the house, so an external party is ruled out. My wife hates cookies and cream ice cream, so I know it wasn't her. My daughter is lactose intolerant, and she breaks out in a rash if she eats dairy products. I have a look at her, no rash, so no ice cream. Now, whenever my son comes downstairs at night, he turns on every single light in the house and never turns them off. When I came downstairs, it was pitch black. So you know what that means. Dun dun dun. Now, I'm being silly here, but you get the idea. With abductive reasoning, we take a series of facts and eliminate possibilities until we get to the most reasonable conclusion. Now, in the beginning, we talked about objective truth versus subjective truth. And we just finished showing how we can know if things are objectively true or not. And that's an important skill to have because we all want to get to the truth, I hope. I wanted to do all of that front-end work to be able to talk about one of the predominant views of the day in our culture, and that is a view known as relativism. Now, people don't go around pronouncing, "I am a relativist," but many people say things like they are. Relativism is the view that all truth is relative, or equally valid. You've heard this viewpoint when you hear things like, there is no truth, or true for you but not for me, or my truth, or you do you, I'm going to do me. Pilate expressed this idea when he asked Jesus in John 19:38, what is truth? Pilate wasn't asking Jesus for a lesson on truth. He was telling Jesus that truth is subjective, as in what was and wasn't true was up to Pilate because of the place of power that he was in. In the matters of the court, he got to determine what was true and what was not. The problem is that most of these statements are self-defeating, or they don't live up to the claim that they try to make. If you look at them closer, when they deny that something is objectively true, they're doing so by making an objective truth claim. Let's start with the statement, there is no truth. Well, that person sure seems to think that it is true that there is no truth. Whenever someone makes a self-defeating statement, ask them a question that uses the statement in it and see what happens. So, if someone says there is no truth, ask them, is that true? And see what happens. How about, all truth is relative. Is that relatively true? Or there are no absolutes. Are you absolutely sure? True for you, but not for me. Is that true for just you or for everyone else too? True for you but not for me may be the mantra of the day, but it's not how the world really works. Try saying that to your bank teller, like, or the police, or the IRS and see how far you get. Some people will make the distinction between hard facts in the material world and moral claims. For example, hard facts would be like how much a rock weighs, and moral claims like it's wrong to kill grandma for fun. Now, we'll get into objective morality much later, but it's easy to show that everyone thinks that some things are wrong for everyone and not just for if you feel like it. They sure think there's a list of things you ought not to do to everyone, especially them. Like if you cut in front of someone in line, they're going to say, hey, you can't do that. Or if you walk up to someone sitting at a table in Starbucks and you take a big long sip of their, you know, iced Quaranta mocha chai wheat grass coffee tea, they're probably going to demand that you pay for another one because that was wrong. Now look, I live in Los Angeles, the land of the protest. And I'm not disparaging people who protest. I mean, praise God, we live in a country that allows us to do that. But whenever people protest, what are they doing? They're trying to get your attention and convince you that something is objectively wrong and it needs to be fixed. The statement they're making is true for everyone and not just them. You know, like, you can't tell a woman what to do with her body, or we ought to be paid more, or the lives of, insert marginalized people group here, are important and they need rights. When people protest, they're making objective truth claims so that other people will vote and change some sort of law or policy. Everyone believes morals are objectively true, even when they say otherwise. Another place that we encounter relativism is in worldviews. This is usually expressed as something like, all religions are the same, or all roads lead to heaven. But this is easy to show that it can't be true. Worldviews make claims about how the world works, and they make claims that often stand against one another. Remember our rules of logic. Something can't be both A and not A at the same time. So, atheists believe that there is no God. Jews, Muslims, and Christians, and Hindus, and Buddhists believe that there is a supernatural force of some kind. If there isn't a supernatural force in charge of everything, then the atheists are right and everybody else is wrong. But they both can't be right at the same time. Christians, Muslims, and Jews believe that there's only one God. Other religions believe in many gods. Either there's only one God or there are many gods. If there's only one God, then the Jews, Muslims, and Christians are right and everyone else is wrong. But if there's many gods, then the Jews, Muslims, and Christians are wrong. But in no way that can they all be right. Christians believe that Jesus rose from the dead. Either he did or he didn't. If he did, the Christians are right and the Jews and the Muslims are wrong. But if he didn't, then the Christians are wrong and the Jews and Muslims are right. But they can't be right at the same time. Now, this has nothing to show which worldview is right. For that, you need to examine the evidence for the claims that they make and use the processes of reasoning we talked about earlier. But either they're all wrong or one of them is right. But they differ so much that they can't all be right at the same time. This is just simple logic. So why am I making such a big deal of this? Isn't it mean or intolerant to point out if someone is wrong? No, truth matters. We use it every day. Certain things you have to get right because the consequences are so weighty. Look, I'm a diabetic. I take two different types of insulin. One makes my blood sugar fall really fast, and one maintains it over a long period of time. And, depending on the situation, I better pick the right vial of insulin. Too much of one and I end up unconscious in the ER. Not enough of the other and I could end up with long-term side effects. So I better pick the right vial at the given time. And just like medical decisions are weighty things, the things that we talk about in this class are weighty things. The ramifications of your worldview have to do with eternity. The weighty concerns that we're talking about are weighty because they are forever. We should care about the truth because Christianity cares about the truth. In 1 Corinthians 15:14-19, Paul writes to the Corinthians, "And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain, and your faith is in vain. We were even found to be misrepresenting God, because we testified about God that he raised Christ, whom he did not raise, if it is true that the dead are not raised. For if the dead are not raised, not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, then your faith is futile, and you are still in your sins. Then those also who have fallen asleep in Christ have perished. If in Christ we have hope in this life only, we are of all people most to be pitied." Paul spells out why the truth matters in his letter to the Corinthians. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then our debts haven't been paid and everything Christianity has taught for 2,000 years is a lie. But if Jesus has risen from the dead, then he has paid the debt. Christianity cares a lot about the truth. And by truth, I mean describing the world the way it really is. In John chapter 8, verses 31 and 32, so Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." John 14, 6, Jesus said to him, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Jesus doesn't say, "I have some of the truth, and I'm one way to get to God." No, he says, "I am the way and the truth, and nobody gets to God except through me." That's a pretty exclusive truth claim. The word truth appears over 146 times in the Bible. And most of these verses in the New Testament talk about people who deny the truth, or that the apostles gave them the truth. And if you weren't doing what the apostles said, you were wrong, not living in truth. As part of our mission as Christ ambassadors, we're to spread the truth to others. Spreading the truth means countering false things with true things. In 2 Corinthians 10, 4-5, Paul writes, "For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God and take every thought captive to obey Christ." Now, don't be put off by what may seem like harsh language, warfare and destroy. Paul isn't talking about waging war against people and destroying them. He's talking about attacking ideas with the truth. People may say true for you, but not for me, but we demand the truth all the time, like from loved ones. No one wants lies from a spouse or a child. In fact, we tell them it was wrong if they lie to us. We want our doctors to prescribe the right medication and the right operations performed. We want our financial advisors and bankers to tell us the truth about the companies that they recommend that we invest in. And we get upset if they trick us into investing in something that tanked but made them a lot of money. We want the courts to convict only the truly guilty. We want employers to tell us the truth and pay us fairly. And we also expect to be told the truth when we pick up a reference book or read an article or watch a news story. We want the truth from advertisers, teachers, and politicians. We assume road signs and medicine bottles and food labels reveal the truth. In fact, we demand the truth for almost every facet of life that affects our money, relationships, safety, or health. Now, even though people may claim that truth and morality doesn't matter, they don't really believe that when someone treats them immorally. But success in life is often dependent on moral choices a person makes. These include choices regarding sex and marriage and children, drugs, money, business dealings. Some choices bring prosperity and others result in ruin. People think morality is subjective because it depends on the subject of the action or the circumstances. As if I think it's okay, then it's okay and you shouldn't worry about it. You want to see an easy way to demonstrate that objective morality exists? Put the phrase "for fun" at the end of an action, like, "Is it ever okay to kill babies for fun?" Or, "Is it ever okay to hold someone down and have your way with them for fun?" Or, "Is it ever okay to shoot up a movie theater for fun?" Hopefully, you said no to all of those things. If a society promotes relativism, that everyone gets to make up their own moral code, and if we teach students that there's no right and wrong, why are we surprised when a couple of students gun down their classmates, or a teenage mother leaves their baby in the trash can? None of this should surprise us in a culture that adheres to relativism. Truth corresponds to reality. Not aligning yourself with reality can have serious consequences on your health and your mental state. Take the case of anorexia. In this scenario, a person's perception of their body does not align with reality. In their mind, they're fat and overweight, so they go to extreme measures to lose weight and try to get skinnier and skinnier to the point where their organs start shutting down and they starve themselves to death. It's a mental disorder. What's going on in their mind doesn't comport with reality. And this vision they have of themselves is not true. And because they can't see that what's true for them is just flat out wrong, they put their lives at risk. Now I ask you, is it caring? Is the caring thing to do for that person to let them live their truth? No, of course not. We want to get them help so they can align what they think on the inside with the truth on the outside. Or what about body integrity identity disorder? This is a rare mental condition where people think they're amputees and they ask a doctor to amputate one of their limbs. They feel so strongly that their leg or their hand or their arm is gone that they want a doctor to remove it for them. And they do that so that their outside can align with their truth on the inside. A while back, there was a woman on Dr. Phil who she had gotten drain cleaner and she put it in her. Actually, she had her doctor help her put drain cleaner into her eyes, making herself blind because she wanted to live as a blind person. This is obviously a serious mental condition that needs help. And if our friends told us that they wanted to have a perfectly good pair of eyes ruined or plucked out or something, you wouldn't just say, you be you, boo. I mean, would you do that? I don't think so. Here's another thought. If the atheists are right, and this physical world is all there is, and we're basically just meat robots walking around, living out our genetic programming, then we might as well lie and cheat and steal to get what we want, because this life is all there is, and there's no consequences in eternity. But we have a term for people who live their life that way. We call them sociopaths. If a society doesn't comport itself to the truth, then that has consequences. And that's why God cares so much about the truth. And that's why we should too. Now, some truths are plainly obvious, and yet people will still deny them. You can make an airtight case full of evidence, and yet people still won't accept that what you're saying is true. Why is that? Why do they shun the truth? Well, there's three reasons why people shun the truth. The first is for rational reasons. They're not convinced by the arguments, or maybe they have arguments that defeat the arguments that they were given. Maybe they don't have all the evidence that you have. Maybe there's a lack of knowledge. And maybe if we can share our knowledge with them, they'll be convinced of something that's true. This is the kind of person we hope that we run into, that if we give them a nice, rational, logical case full of evidence, that they'll be convinced of what we're saying is true. Now, as much as we want to proclaim that man is a rational being, the truth is he's also emotional. And emotions often get in the way of rational thinking. For many people, Christianity comes with a lot of baggage. They may have had a bad experience at a former church, or they know Christians who don't act very Christian-like. For them, becoming a Christian might be like going back to a restaurant that you got food poisoning in. Even if the restaurant offers to let you come back and inspect the meat, inspect the cooking counters, inspect the cooking process, make sure all the things are up to snuff, you probably still won't want to go back there because it literally left a bad taste in your mouth. And church can be that way for a lot of people too. Spiritual abuse in the church is a real thing. And people get manipulated all the time to give up the resources for the church. People get manipulated into sexual favors or encounters. And if that happened to someone and they were able to get out of it, it would probably be really hard to trust another church. I mean, that would be a definite barrier, don't you think? And also another one. One of God's parts is that of a father. Imagine how hard it must be for someone who comes from a household where their father was abusive and they had lots of problems. You think that might be a barrier to developing a close relationship to God, to have to call him your father? I think so. On a side note, this is why living out the gospel is so important. Most people won't listen to a thing that you have to say if you have bad character. The first encounter most people have with Christianity is through Christians. So if they see people who call themselves Christians acting vulgar, obnoxious, dishonest, or mean-spirited, or hypocritical, that's a big one, why would they want to be any part of that? The third category of reasons why people won't agree with the truth claim are for volitional reasons. They don't want a claim to be true. And there are two different types of people in this group, but it basically boils down to the same objection. The cost is too high. The first group of volitional objectors are the ones who can often be said, I just want to live my life the way I want to live my life. They think that becoming a Christian means a life having to have all the fun sucked out of it. All they see about Christianity is a bunch of unthinking rule followers, and they want no part of that, thank you very much. Or they develop a lifestyle counter to what Christianity teaches, and they don't want to give that up. These people aren't on a truth quest. They're on a happiness quest. If something causes them discomfort, it's not good. If something makes them happy, it's good. The gospel starts off with, "You're messed up and you need help." That's not a very attractive opening statement to someone who thinks they have it all handled on their own. Most people don't want to be held accountable to anyone but themselves. They want to feel like they are in charge of their own lives, so they resist. And frankly, this is where most objectors fall. I know I certainly did. Before I accepted that Christianity was true, I had a serious problem with people telling me what to do or how I should live my life. I thought I knew what being a good person looked like, and I didn't need anyone to tell me how to do that. I was an independent thinker, after all. Now, if you want to see an example of volitional objection, go onto YouTube and look up Frank Turek in his Q&As, and he'll ask people, if Christianity was proven to be true, would you become a Christian? And they flat out say no. This is not a logical objection. This is a willful objection. They don't want Christianity to be true. Now, for the second group in this category, there is too great of a social or familial price to pay if they were to agree with you. Not only would they have to admit to themselves they were wrong, but they'd also risk alienating their peer group and maybe their family. This is a big deal. We've seen all too well recently the kind of vitriol that gets unleashed against people on the opposing sides on a place like Facebook or Twitter or YouTube. Simply changing your mind on a topic means that you're now going to be subject to all of that. Or what about when the church gets attached to a certain polarizing political figure? And people have seen the political mudslinging going back and forth. And they think, if I come out as a Christian, people are going to associate me with that guy or girl. Or even worse, they think now I have to vote for that person? Being very public about your positions can also get you fired or blacklisted in certain industries. People have a lot at stake when they come out on topics these days. Losing relationships is one thing. But if you have a family to provide for and you know there's a possibility of hostility in the workplace or even termination, you might think twice before coming out on a particular side of something or announcing that you're now a different party or a member of a different belief system. This gets taken to a whole different level in countries where religious freedom is not a right protected by the law like it is here in the U.S. In places like Egypt, if you're not a Muslim, there's many opportunities that are closed to you. In many Muslim nations, it is against the law to convert someone from Islam to another belief system. So if you're a Christian in some Muslim countries and you try to convince your Muslim friend that Christianity is true, you could end up in jail or worse. In some areas, Muslims who become Christians are executed. So a Muslim has to weigh the cost of losing their livelihood, their possessions, their family, and even their own lives in some cases. That's a pretty weighty decision to have to make. Now look, Christianity cares about the truth. And truth matters because we should live our lives in line with what's true. Above all else, above our social status, above our career advancement, above our desire to be liked, Christians should love truth. Now, I'm not suggesting that we're putting truth over God, because all true things are God's things. But we must care about the truth very deeply if we want to be transformed and want others to be transformed. Christianity doesn't hide the truth. Now, Christians might not tell the truth, and some churches might not give people the whole truth, but that's not by God's design. The same information available to the clergy is available to the congregants in God's word to us. That's also the sign of a cult, when the leader keeps teachings from the congregation, or when they primarily teach from like personal visions or dreams that they have received that none of the other members have access to. Watch out for those types. I'm not a Christian because it makes me feel good or because it makes my life easier. Quite the contrary, actually. I'm a Christian because it's true. In fact, the only reason anyone should be a Christian is because it's true. Not because it makes them a better person or forms better societies, although these things are wonderful side effects. And not because my parents were or because I got a burning in the bosom when I prayed about it. If you want to consider yourself a Christian, you should be a Christian because it's true. Christianity is the best explanation for why things are the way they are.